Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dory, the communications manager here at the Denver Audubon. We're an independent, nonprofit chapter of the National Audubon Society, and we believe that birds are not just beautiful, they're vital. They're messengers of ecosystem health, and when we protect them, we also nurture the well-being of our communities, the environment, and the planet. This podcast, The Curious Bird, is part of a larger effort to uplift what we call a voice of the sky, a growing community of people like you who feel called to speak up, act boldly, and care deeply for the future of Earth and all her wild beings. Our goal is to share the stories of inspired advocates and to reflect on the creativity, interconnectedness, and wonder that the natural world awakens in us. We hope these stories spark lifelong learning, deepen your sense of stewardship, and remind us all of the power of collective care. So, wherever and whenever you're tuning in from, thank you. We're so glad you're here. Let's take flight together and dive into today's episode of The Curious Bird. I'm so excited to have with me here today, Emma Riley.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to meet you. And this is the first time we're meeting in person, and it's already wonderful.
Yeah.
So we're here to talk Hawkwatch. And as soon as we walked into the nature center from afar, she's like, ooh, Harrier's Hawk. Ooh, Harrier's Hawk. And I was like, okay, well, I got to bring this over here because the enthusiasm is incredible.
It never stops. I can't turn it off.
Isn't that amazing how birds and animals can do that?
Yeah, I think it really allows me to connect with the world around me, like at any moment. And it's a real joy in my life.
Yeah, we talk a lot about that. And I just talked to Ryan Dabala as well. We had a conversation, and what comes up so often is joy and shared joy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. And, you know, getting to work up at the Hawkwatch, what we'll get into, but I get to share that joy with volunteers every day. And it's really amazing. It's a gift.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait to talk more about it. Yeah. But first, I want to introduce you. Emma Riley is a raptor biologist from Fort Collins, Colorado, with a Bachelor's of Science in Conservation Biology from Colorado State University. In her last semester at CSU, she met a graduate student studying for Ruginous Hawks and was lucky enough to volunteer in the field with her for a month post-graduation. From that moment, she was hooked on raptors and has since worked Hawkwatch seasons in Minnesota, New Mexico, and in Colorado at Dinosaur Ridge. Emma works as the lead counter and project lead at Dinosaur Ridge Hawkwatch, with this being her fourth season at the site. I love that phrase. From that point, she was hooked.
Yeah.
What was it about Ferruginous Hawks and your time with them that was like, this is it?
So, like I said, when I was in my undergrad, I was taking my final field ornithology course. I had two ornithology courses, and I had a teaching assistant, Sarah, and we were misnetting songbirds for our lab, which was such a privilege as a college student. And she was talking about trapping raptors. And I was like, how on earth could you possibly do that? And she brought in her pigeons that she used as lure birds for them, because they use invasive species to trap raptors. And she kept hers as pets. And so she brought them in, and I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. Yeah. And COVID had just hit. So we were very lucky to do an outdoor lab, but, you know, spaced. And when I graduated that December, there was no jobs, no work, because, you know, COVID was kind of closing everything. And she needed some volunteer work done. So I went through about 10,000 trail cam photos.
Wow.
Looking at nests. She was studying the Ferruginous Hawks nesting on platforms like Osprey, actually, and seeing if they were taking to those nests. Previously, they'd been easily displaced by oil and gas development. And it turns out with her study, she's going to get it published soon. So I won't spoil everything, but I know it's exciting. We had some really cool results. And so I looked through the trail cam photos and I dissected hawk casts, like the owl pellet equivalent for hawks. And then, she brought me out into the field and I did a lot of telemetry and I helped band nestlings for a different grad student and just getting to see these birds on a landscape that was so massive and many people deem so barren, you know, out in Southwest Wyoming, where the oil and gas are, you know, where that work is being done. And just seeing these birds thrive, and watching them use the landscape. And, you know, we put GPS tags on these birds to see where they migrated. And every year they came back to the same nest. And just seeing that, you know, the movement ecology and the way that they use the landscape, and just getting to be up close to these birds, it was the coolest thing I'd ever done. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was hooked. I could not get enough, and I still can't.
Mm-hmm. I love the phrase movement ecology. That I have not heard.
Yeah, it's I have big dreams of going back to grad school one day. Mm-hmm. And movement ecology is kind of my interest, my realm of interests. The way that birds move across the landscape, mm-hmm. I find really interesting, and, you know, led very easily into me working at a migration site.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible. I was talking recently to Dr. Kyle Horton of BirdCast, and he mentioned aeroecology, which is the acknowledgement that the sky itself is a habitat.
Cool. I've never heard that term. That's mm-hmm. amazing. Kristen Ruick, one of the creators of BirdCast, she was my ornithology professor.
No way.
Yeah. And for that class, she said, I don't care what you learn. Obviously, mm-hmm. she's a great professor. I don't want to. Yeah. She said, I don't care what you take away from this class, as long as you take away a passion for birds. Mm-hmm. And she did it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What makes you so passionate about birds?
You know, kind of what we touched on earlier. I think that birding for me is a really meditative practice. Mm. I think that I get a lot of connection with the natural world around me. I get a lot of, you know, there's a lot of quieting the mind for me, which is, mm-hmm. I think, something that we're all looking for.
Absolutely.
And being able to share that joy, you know, with others. Mm-hmm. Birders in and around Denver and in and around the world, you know, we have that one thing that we can connect over. And being able to experience the natural world in that way, and in a way that is so seasonal with mm-hmm. migration. Mm-hmm. And I really relate to that with, you know, slowing down in the winter and then picking back up in the summer. And also just being able to look at birds of prey in particular, and using them as kind of keystone species. So, you know, these apex predators in these landscapes, being able to look at how they're doing, and we can learn so much about the rest of the landscape from them. And mm-hmm. I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, I find that a core theme that comes up in conversations when I talk to people is birds as our teachers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that they've taught me so much. And, you know, in the grand scheme of life, I've only been doing this for 5 years now, mm-hmm. and I can't wait to see what else I learn.
Yeah. Beyond slowing down and coming to presence, what are some other things you'd say birds have taught you?
That's a really good question. I think they've taught me to, we're just, you know, joy again.
Yeah.
To find the joy in really mundane moments. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be anywhere, and seeing even pigeons in the city can be exciting. And just being able to share that with people, connections, mm-hmm. I think, is something that's been really big for me. And that's, you know, so not related directly to the birds, but being able to meet passionate, like-minded people mm-hmm. That care about conservation as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not just about birds for me. It is, you know, truly about conserving wildlife and the ecosystems mm-hmm. around us, and, you know, being able to share that knowledge with others to, you know, hopefully get someone else inspired to care mm-hmm. is, I think, a real privilege.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They are definitely a portal to joy, and I think there's never enough mentioning of joy because it's a necessity right now. And
yeah, totally.
I love that you brought up pigeons, because I love walking along the street and there's this beautiful gray and iridescent being just strutting along next
to me. Totally. No, even starlings. My first ornithology course, we saw starlings, and I didn't know anything about birds. I mm-hmm. birded a little bit, and I was like, these birds are amazing. They're mm-hmm. so beautiful. And people mm-hmm. around me were like, oh, you know, it's just the starlings. Like, they're invasive. We don't like them. And mm-hmm. I was kind of taken aback, because I was like, oh, well, I think they're really pretty, you know? Mm-hmm. And like being able to, yeah, take that moment and find mm-hmm. Beauty in something other people may view as mundane.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
a gift. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I love that you bring up starlings, because I talk about starlings yes. too. And I'm like, they're so gorgeous. And you get that. Sometimes that backlash of yeah. they're an invasive species. And
it's not
to
their
me,
fault.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what I say. It's not their fault. And no. if we spew that
I don't want to use an extreme word as hate, but I don't have a better one at the moment. Yeah. You know, we have to divest from that to be able to spread love and compassion to a greater capacity.
Totally. And I think, you know, that's something that we can touch on that doesn't just, you know, apply to birds with, you know, being able to recognize that there are situations that people, birds, whatever it may be, get themselves into. And it's not their fault, but we can approach it with, you know, compassion or whatever it may be, even just curiosity.
Absolutely. Curiosity is essential because curiosity to me comes from a space of open-heartedness, a space of neutrality and exploration rather than assumptiveness or judgment.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that I've kind of picked up in with a lot of the connections I've made doing this work and even just working with the volunteers that I work with up at the Hawk Watch or other, you know, hawk watchers and ornithologists I've met. Everyone kind of seems to try to lead with that like heart-led practices. And I think that that's a really amazing way to navigate the world and navigate conservation.
Absolutely. And I love that birds offer this connection of community that you talk about. It's this connection of caring, heart-centered people. And what I've been seeing too is that even if people aren't connected, I've talked to different people, there's an essence of experiencing similar qualities of joy, of meditativeness, of presence. And so they're connecting us in ways that are unseen and intangible.
Yeah. And I talk to people or I talk about this a lot, but I think that in the world of wildlife, birds are the things that people have the most connection with. You know, we're not seeing these large mammals every day that everyone loves. I wish we did. That'd be amazing.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, birds, everyone has a connection to birds, whether it's pigeons in a city or, you know, your grandma's bird feeders or whatever it may be. And to be able to, kind of all come together on that and use that, those shared experiences to connect with one another is, I think, only going to do us more good.
Absolutely. It's building that web of, for me, one of the things is celebration.
Celebration
of life and other beings and then being able to act in an inspired way from there.
And I mean, like, I if you ask some of the volunteers up at Dinosaur Ridge, and hopefully you'll get to see on Monday, I celebrate up there. You know, I have shed tears up there because of the migration that we've seen, and you know, being able to share that with others. And you know, I can come to the Hawk Watch with, you know, having a bad day, going through some pretty heavy personal stuff, and you know, a ferruginous hawk will come by or whatever it may be, even just you know, we'll get some sandhill cranes that move over. We had an amazing movement of sandhill cranes yesterday. And there's always something that, you know, will leave you feeling a little bit better than when you came in.
Yeah. Quality of uplifting us.
Totally. Totally.
So let's talk Hawk Watch. What is Hawk Watch? And I'm going out on a Hawk Watch event next week. So what are some things I could maybe expect?
Totally. That's a great question. So hawk watching in general is, you know, there's these Hawk Watch sites across the country, across the world. Stations that have been monitored. Our site at Dinosaur Ridge has been monitored since 1990. And people come out either in the spring or the fall. Usually the sites are only really good for one of those migrations, one or the other. And the raptors that inhabit or migrate through the United States or wherever these sites may be will concentrate along these flyways. So, you know, a lot like the passerine flyways that we may see or whatever. You know, whatever flyway we're talking about, the Rocky Mountain flyway is the one that we've got here. And, you know, birds will concentrate across coasts, other mountain ranges, whatever it may be. But we can see these really nice concentrations coming from South America all the way up into the United States and so and into Canada. So there's plenty of people called hawk watchers. And they're very niche. It's a very niche world to get into. And I'd never heard of it until I met the grad student that I was working for and then started looking for raptor work. And we folk will congregate at these sites and spend 10, 12 weeks each season monitoring the migration. And so on any given day, I'll speak for Dinosaur Ridge. You know, we can see just a couple birds too. I think my best day over the last couple of years there was 254 migratory raptors, which in the grand scheme of migration and hawk watches across the world is a really low sight. We count about 23 to 2,500 birds per season right now. It's changed a lot over the course of the last 35 years that the site's been running. But, you know, there are some sites, I've got a friend that's working in Colombia right now, and they're counting 30,000 birds a day.
Whoa.
Yeah. And it's these birds that all spend the winter in, you know, South America and Argentina, the Swainson's hawk. They spend the winter in Argentina, and then they'll come up and breed in Colorado. And so it's like all of South America's, these birds that are going to migrate up into North America, coming through these sites. And so there's a site in Mexico, Veracruz. It's called the River of Raptors. And they get like a million raptors that migrate through a season. Yeah, so there's these pathways that people have figured out where they are, and they station and monitor them. And at Dinosaur Ridge in particular, we can get birds that come really low right overhead. We can see Mount Morrison to the west of us and Green Mountain to the east of us. We're kind of nestled in that little valley, if anyone's familiar. And a lot of our birds will take that western ridge, but it really varies on winds and temperatures and a lot of different weather components to know exactly what to expect. But as we gear up, you know, this, our migration has really kicked off in the last week. Yesterday we counted 91 migratory raptors. We're hoping to have another really great day up there today. And so, you know, as these next couple weeks come until, you know, the end of April, we're really getting into that peak. So hopefully we'll start to see some more of those Swainson's hawks and other of those south birds that are still steadily making their way up to us.
Wow. So I was talking recently, I mentioned Dr. Kyle Horton, and we discussed how 80% of migratory birds migrate at night. So is this different for raptors?
So that's a really good point, is that raptors migrate during the day. And there are some people that, you know, like to discuss, I can't speak on the research efforts that have been done on this. I would love to look into it after this, but there might be something to say for the difference in it of, you know, these predators migrating during the day and then the prey birds, if you will, you know, migrating at night. And, but yeah, the raptors that we see are diurnal, so active during the day, migrating during the day. We are counting up there from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day. We've played around a lot with the hours of the count, and starting earlier as the peak season continues, we'll probably get up there a little bit earlier, but we see some really amazing end of day flights. But yeah, these birds are, you know, they're roosting somewhere overnight. In the morning, they may hunt a little bit, and then they're spending the day migrating. And on average, these raptors are migrating about 300 miles a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can you imagine flying 300 miles a day?
That'd be so amazing. Just every day I think about what
it must be. If I could be a Swainson's
hawk. Oh my goodness, I know. I know. I had that conversation yesterday.
Did you? what was the meat of it? What would happen if you were a Swainson's hawk?
I think that I love this human existence, but who could deny wanting to be a bird? I just think it's, what a cool way to explore the world. And like you were talking about, that aeroecology is so interesting, of the sky being an ecosystem. And what a cool existence to experience that.
I was thinking a lot about that with you and being in Wyoming under this vast sky, and then Dinosaur Ridge, you're hiking up, being under the blanket of this vast sky. What is it like to have an experience and relationship with the sky?
It is really humbling. Getting to, you know, experience that and stare at the sky for 8 hours a day makes me, and has made me, appreciate and look at the world differently, truly. I notice things more, you know, I think I'm a bit more observant. And I think that just in general, it really has been humbling. I think that it makes you realize how small you are. It's like looking at the Grand Canyon, you know, of just seeing something so massive in front of you and knowing that you're just a speck in front of that massiveness. And, you know, we'll get raptors that fly below us at Dinosaur Ridge. And then we'll get raptors that you can see them in your binoculars and they literally disappear in front of your eyes. That's how high they are. And just getting to really recognize the ecosystem of the sky, and just, seeing that it's not just like this concept of a sheet above us, you know, that is so easy to kind of forget about. I think it's really greatened and deepened my appreciation for the world around me.
Yeah, that it too is a life force.
Totally. And I mean, even when we're not seeing birds flying, we're seeing planes up there, we have paragliders. I mean, just getting to see people experience and enjoy the world in such a 3D, 4D kind of experience is yeah, I think it's just really made me take an extra second to look at the world around me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, quality of decentralizing our individual existence and then our human existence.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, with that, like, well, most of the raptors that we see migrate individually, and then every once in a while we'll see them move all together. And those experiences are really exciting. But to see that they're, you know, either way, they'll make it where they're going, you know, and that innate sense in them of where to go is amazing and still a bit of a mystery to scientists. Mm-hmm. And that's very exciting that there's some mystery still there. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, it'd be really cool to understand everything. Yeah. And on the other hand, I think it's a good practice to allow that mystery to be a mystery and to just marvel in it.
Yeah. Oh, I like that word. And in mystery, there's play.
Yeah. And the curiosity, you know, of we can really try to predict what's going to happen up there. At Dinosaur Ridge, we get the best migration with east winds. Mm-hmm. And, but there's no real loop rules to it, you know, and being able to always be curious of what the next day is going to bring is a pleasure.
Yeah, and witnessing them and allowing them to be outside of our prediction reinforces that they're these sovereign, beautiful, worthy beings.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, being up at Dinosaur Ridge in particular, where we've got fossils and dinosaur prints. And it's, I think there's something really interesting to be said for the fact that we've got a raptor migration coming right over these dinosaur prints and fossils. Mm-hmm. And I know that that's, you know, the case in a lot of places probably, but to have it so visual in front of us is really cool. But to see these birds and know that, you know, we just get to enjoy them for 10 seconds and then they get to go live for however long they're going to live. And we just get to appreciate them for this moment. It really makes you appreciate it.
Yeah. I love that you brought up the dinosaur footprints. It feels like a spectrum of time.
Yeah. It does feel like a gift to be almost like allowed into that spectrum, you know, and to be able to bear witness to this prehistoric time continuing in front of our eyes. Because some of these birds, and like I said, we had the sandhill cranes. We had 1,006, we estimate, sandhill cranes fly over yesterday, all throughout the whole day. Mm-hmm. And those birds in particular, talk about prehistoric.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, to be able to see raptors migrating, you know, we had our first osprey of the season come by yesterday, and we get a lot of American kestrels at the end of the day. To have all of these birds coming through next to the sandhill cranes with the dinosaur prints underneath you, it feels Jurassic, and it feels, yeah, like this secret almost.
Yeah, like a portal.
Yeah, yeah, of something that is just so cool and so rich of history. And to be able to, yeah, like I said, bear witness to even a second of that is, I think, really important and has been really influential in my life.
Mm-hmm. I've been reflecting a lot on the quality of abundance as truth, and that being abundance being the opportunity to be a speck of dust on a planet in the richness of all these other beings. And you describing that moment feels like that to be how fortunate we are.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, also how fortunate I feel to be able to share that with other people.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing for me to experience that as a biologist. I know how cool it is. You know, that's why I'm doing this. But to be able to share that with other people that are curious or that would never have thought of that. You know, Dinosaur Ridge is a really cool site because we're located on a public trail that's heavily used. And so we get people from all walks of life that have never thought about a raptor a day in their life or, you know, see red-tailed hawks all the time or have a Cooper's hawk that, you know, eats birds off their feeders or whatever it may be, whatever connection they have to birds or if they have no connection. People are always very curious about what's the deal with the hawks coming through and being able to share that and hopefully, you know, be able to spark that, those thoughts about abundance and where I fall into that kind of role and this larger ecosystem that we're inhabiting is, yeah, so great.
Yeah, and how beautiful and amazing of you to be a facilitator of that experience.
Yeah, I feel very lucky. And I, yeah, people, I have those conversations every day up there. You know, I feel very lucky to do what I do and to be able to share it.
Yeah. So you said you've met people from all walks of life in these Hawk Watch volunteer days. Is there a particular experience from a volunteer that you got to witness transformation?
Oh, man, that is such a good question. Yeah, you know, I wouldn't know. I can't say it's like one particular pinpointed moment,
yeah.
But I have two volunteers that have been volunteering with me pretty consistently on Thursdays for the last 4 years. And it's a husband and a wife. And, you know, for over the course of the 4 years when they started, I mean, their identification skills were pretty minimal, which is very understandable and pretty classic when you're coming to a hawk watch, because you're not just trying to identify a perched red tail from however far away. You're trying to identify a hawk in flight, which is like a whole different beast yeah. of identification. But to see them grow in their identification with it, you know, being able to identify what's in front of you, I've seen really spark joy in people.
Mm.
And being able to share those tips of how I can tell what I'm looking at and being able to connect with that bird in particular, mm-hmm. I've really been able to see that passion grow in them.
Mm-hmm.
And their excitement, you know, they've brought other people to the Hawk Watch. They've gotten other people interested in volunteering, and they've been, yeah, some of our best supporters. And, you know, it started with a curiosity in raptors. And mm-hmm. Now it's all of our favorite experiences is getting to work together on Thursdays and continue to practice that. And, you know, another quick answer to that is yeah. I've got a 13 going on 14-year-old. He'll be 14 soon, cool. volunteer. He's fantastic. And he's been birding. I don't know how long he's been birding. I'm not going to try and answer that. I don't think it's been insanely long.
Yeah.
But he is, last year was his birthday, his 13th birthday, up at the Ridge with us. And he saw, I know, that's amazing. He saw his lifer broad-winged hawk. And that was super exciting for us. And while he already has the spark, he's excited, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to influence the spark at all because
mm-hmm.
It's there. It's fiery. Mm-hmm. But being able to just share that, like, really important moment of, mm-hmm. you know, hopefully he's going to remember for the rest of his life. On his 13th birthday, he got his lifer broadwing talk at Dinosaur mm-hmm. Ridge. And, you know, the broadwings are really special because they only come through on migration here. So
mm-hmm.
we really get to just see them in a moment of time, and then they're yeah. gone. And yeah, just being able to share those moments of joy has brought so much joy to my life.
One, amazing for you to hold space for these sparks. You know, I think it allows their fire to grow. And what an incredible example you're setting for this 13 going on 14
yeah.
kid. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a couple young birders that come up. He's got a friend who's 17 and he's been birding since he was 4. And I was talking about going on an international trip the other day, and he started rattling off the endemic species that I could expect to see in that
wow.
country. And I was like, I hadn't even looked into this yet,
yeah.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
But to see this young generation of birders mm-hmm. get really excited and, you know, volunteer their time over their spring break
mm-hmm.
and spend their birthday at the Hawk Watch with us is, you know, selfishly, it's amazing for me because I get to feel that hope.
Yeah.
Or the future of these birds. And yeah, I mean, I find so much joy in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked with kids for about 6 years in outdoor education. And that was always my favorite part, was just absorbing their curiosity and feeling so grateful for that reminder.
Yeah. It brings your like childlike joy back in my experience. I also worked with kids when I was a student at CSU, and I worked for their environmental learning center. And it's one of the only spaces you're like encouraged to play off trail,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, we a lot of times are really discouraged from, which is
mm-hmm.
Important. But being able to bring these kids out into the middle of the woods and like tell them it's okay to climb trees and pick mm-hmm. up, you know, sticks and mm-hmm. see what's living under the rocks and whatever mm-hmm. it may be, is that really, I think, was one of the first times I'd been reminded of my childlike joy that mm-hmm. I'd lost for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think since then, just working with birds, it doesn't feel like it's gone anywhere.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
I think that's so important what you brought up of kids playing in trees, because it builds a relationship with the natural world and seeing that we are, as humans, in relationship with the natural world.
Yeah, yeah. And I have, you know, this kind of similar conversation frequently with people, again, about everyone has that connection to birds somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a really amazing way to cultivate a relationship with the natural mm-hmm. world.
And it's so wonderful for humans and the community. And why is this observation and volunteerism critical for the raptors?
Yeah. So, you know, as a counter at a hawk watch, especially Dinosaur Ridge,
mm-hmm.
these birds love to fly everywhere. They'll fly below you, above you, west and east of you. I can do my best to try and see them all and get IDs on all of them, but it's nearly impossible. And that's something that we've proven at Dinosaur Ridge. So this site was founded in 1990 by Dwayne Nelson and Joey Kellner, who's still very active in the Denver birding community. We're a part of the first, you know, exploratory sites counts on this. And the site was staffed really well until about 2000. And then between the years of 2000 and 2020, so for about 20 years there, there was a real variation in the number of hours and the number of people that were staffed at this site. And so, you know, some of the hours, you know, some of the seasons they had less than 100 hours observed. And mind you, I'm up there 8 hours a day. So it's a very, you know, it's a very small amount of the season that you're covering. I think we've already counted 180 hours in March alone. Wow. And we can see that reflected in our data. You know, like I said kind of earlier about the differences and the changes that we've seen in the migration at this site in particular. In the 90s, we had some really great numbers of rough-legged hawks, for example. Now, you know, this year we are lucky to count two. The last 2 years, we haven't seen any. And we have this large chunk of time that we can't really pull any inferences from the data. Mm-hmm. Because it is so variable, and there wasn't a consistent protocol being set and a consistent coverage of it, that now that Denver Field Ornithologists has taken over and, you know, this organization has the time and the funds to be able to put more effort into this site. I was hired on in 2022 as the first paid counter in a really long time, and being able to be there 8 hours a day is great, but being able to be there 8 hours a day with people there to help spot birds all around you has created these really consistent, concise counts over the last 3 years that we're actually able to start using this data.
So could you give some examples of how this data can inform conservation decisions?
Yeah. So one example in the eastern part of the United States, American kestrels, the smallest falcon that we see in North America, is declining in population numbers. Mm-hmm. But scientists on the field, like on the ground, weren't really noticing a decline in numbers of birds in front of them, but using the migration data, they were able to see an actual decline. And with these analysis, you know, we see ebbs and flows of populations every couple of years. It's very natural, but they were able to recognize that the American kestrels were declining, and now they're starting to put effort towards conserving them and, you know, maybe putting out more nest boxes or whatever it may be. But because of those numbers, you're able to take that data and send it to government officials, to nonprofits, to the parks, whatever it may be. And they can use that to get funding to, you know, implement projects or whatever it may be. But yeah, these birds weren't being noticed, that there was less of them. It was just something that the numbers were able to show.
Yeah. And I noticed a little deep dive on the Hawk Watch website. There's a quote that says, "Raptors need you. What do they need from us? And how can we help give that beyond counting?"
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I think that raptors aren't the only ones in need from us, but, you know, human development, human impact, even scientists, you know, we have messed up in the past. We have made the wrong decisions, and there's a lot of talk about how do we right them. And raptors, you know, for example, with DDT and the bald eagles and peregrine falcons and, you know, their declines in populations. That was something that we caused. So that's something that, in my opinion, we need to do, tread lightly, but, you know, try and right our wrongs. And a lot of these birds, yeah, are being displaced by our own actions. And hawk watching started because people were hunting raptors as target practice, like not even, you know, just practicing. And a lot of people can still view these birds as pests. A lot of people, you know, don't recognize the harm in hunting with lead bullets. That's something that really impacts raptor populations. So I think that raptors need you is a very broad statement, but I think to start, you know, they need you to pay attention to how our actions impact their populations or even just an individual.
Yeah. Wow, you touched on so many things, and I'm like seeing all these tangents I could take with that. But one of the first things that comes to me is just that attention that you talked about and how attention is a force. It's a directed energy.
Yeah.
And our attention is our life.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it a lot with looking at the sky and mm-hmm. having these connections to the natural world around us. I mm-hmm. think that however our attention is grabbed mm-hmm. in, the, you know, towards the world of conservation is something that we should really hold on to and we should really run mm-hmm. towards. Mm-hmm. And it has been a real treat to be able to sometimes be the spark of that attention for folks.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk a little bit about, you know, embracing that caring attention. Like you said, it's not just raptors. Mm-hmm. It's when it's raptors, it's their prey.
Yeah.
It's other beings. And so how are birds connected to everything? And how does helping birds help the greater planet?
Yeah. So I think one of the main things that I think about when, you know, looking at the relationship between birds and the greater planet is that they are migratory. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're looking at these birds that we may only see for 4, 5, 6 months of the year, but they're going on to go live in Argentina for the winter, or, you know, the rough-legged hawks that overwinter in Colorado are going up to the Arctic Circle to breed. Mm-hmm. And I think it's right off the bat a really great lesson at recognizing the connectedness mm-hmm. of the world. You know, one example is the Swainson's hawks in Argentina. You know, after the 70s and DDT was banned in the United States, down in Argentina, they started using DDT in like the 90s. Mm. And it took scientists a long time to recognize why these populations were declining. And then we finally realized that on their wintering grounds, they were, you know, having issues. Mm. And, you know, I think it's a pretty Western mindset to be very individualistic mm-hmm. and not collaborative. And I think scientists as a whole in the past, I think we're getting a lot better at it. And I think that that's one huge thing that we've been taught from raptors is that we need to collaborate with mm-hmm. each other.
I really love that you brought up the aspect of collaboration. That's something I consider a lot, is just separation is an illusion.
Yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. it is. And I think that it's in my face every day looking mm-hmm. at the hawk watch and just experiencing that every day. But yeah, we're so separated. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I was lucky enough, my dad raised me traveling and mm-hmm. I went to India in 2020. And the first and greatest thing that sticks out of my mind is how community-based they were, how at night, you know, until 10, 11 o'clock at night, everyone's sitting in front of their houses as a community experiencing life together. And birds and raptors, yeah, not just raptors, all birds, I think, really have taught me at least that community is crucial mm-hmm. and that it's a gift mm-hmm. and that collaboration between people, that sharing of ideas is something to really cherish. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I really credit raptors to really opening my mind a lot on that.
Mm. In your opinion, what are some ways that we can foster and cultivate community and collaboration?
That's a really good question. you know, I think the first thing that comes to mind is asking each other for help mm. and admit when you can't do something by yourself mm-hmm. Is really huge. I think we see that with birds in the way that, you know, there's plenty of species out there that work more than just a pair mm-hmm. to take care of young birds, or, you know, we'll see birds migrate in huge numbers together and, you know, parents feeding birds or whatever it may be mm-hmm. that example of working together is huge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think what comes up for me when you say that is the concept of receptivity. Mm. And when we are receptive to other people and to support, we are more receptive
yeah.
to everything.
I agree with that. I completely agree with that. And I think that also goes with that like open-minded bit mm-hmm. of just recognizing that while we may not understand everything, that mm-hmm. that's okay.
Mm-hmm. And I think that on that same spectrum, we find that humans want to give.
Yeah.
And to cultivate that habit of giving,
yeah.
it expands to people and then it expands to, you know, beyond humans, to yeah. animals, and cultivates giving.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, giving is something that I see within the birding community a lot. I mm-hmm. see a lot of people, you know, even if it's my volunteers that I was talking about earlier, they bring peanut M&Ms every week. They don't this year because we've got peanut allergies up there, but they bring other snacks, you know, and just that recognition of I may have something to give. And if I could do that, why wouldn't I? Mm-hmm. is really beautiful. And something that I think that we as humans, could always do a better job on. But mm-hmm. I agree that I think that it is very natural for people to want to help. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's very evident when people do something that's helpful and mm-hmm. they feel good about it, you know? And mm-hmm. I think that sometimes people find shame in that, mm-hmm. that we should be able to give without getting anything in return. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think that we should give regardless of how we feel after mm-hmm. it, and that there shouldn't be any shame surrounded it at all, because at the end of the day, looking out for our community is way more important than any shame you may feel.
Yeah, I love that. Divesting from shame is essential. It keeps us small. It keeps us constricting. It keeps us from acting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think at the Hawk Watch, you know, I've really learned that in just, you know, bird identification. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, such a small thing to attribute to a large concept. But, you know, as a counter, I worked out as the count interpreter at Hawk Ridge Hawk Watch in Minnesota and Duluth. Part of my job was to run up and down the road mm-hmm. and holler about what birds we were seeing. Because the counters were off, kind of separated to do their job and not be bothered. They get a lot of birds there. Mm-hmm. And so I would, you know, hoot and holler about whatever bird was flying by. And I still do it to this day at the Hawk Watch. But I'll be wrong, you know, all the time. I see so many red tails up at mm-hmm. Dinosaur Ridge that at some point they're going to start to look like something else. Mm-hmm. And I am confidently wrong all the time about things. Mm-hmm. And I have had to really just put my shame to the side mm-hmm. of just accepting that, okay, people are wrong. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at a bird that's so far away. And even if it's right mm-hmm. above me, I had a zone-tailed hawk come above me in New Mexico with a friend of mine, the friend that's in Colombia, actually. And it took us like 15 minutes to piece together what that bird was, because mm-hmm. it was right above us, but it was so confusing. And, but you know, like there shouldn't be any shame in being wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a privilege as a human being to be able mm-hmm. to recognize when you're wrong and to be able to admit it, because I think that there shouldn't be any shame in being a silly little human.
Yeah. Yeah.
Making silly little human mistakes.
Yeah. And I think that's really brave to set that example, because especially in today's times, there's a lot of there can be, particularly in the online realm, a lot of hostility, and people are afraid to make mistakes, to be wrong. And what that fear does is only paralyze us. And we don't need, you know, that paralysis by analysis.
Yeah.
We need action.
That's a great way to put it. And I think there's plenty of things in the world that paralyze us mm-hmm. outside of that. And I think if we're able to shift the shame from, man, that was so embarrassing to be wrong. And I just told all of the volunteers up here that that American Kestrel was a sharp-shinned hawk. Or mm-hmm. I thought that a red tail had a really long tail, and I was trying to convince myself it was a goshawk. Like, these things happen, you know? I've been doing this for a while. I definitely am skilled at what I do. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's the shame. And I think that being able to laugh at ourselves is a really mm-hmm. important trait to have.
Absolutely. I mean, I was literally just thinking about this a few minutes ago, because I was like, I started the podcast saying ferruginous, not ferruginous. Yeah. And I was like, well, I can either rabbit hole on that, or I can let it go and be present in this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's those things where it's such a small thing. And I do the same thing all the time mm-hmm. where I'm like, oh man, like I just said something and that was wrong. Or, mm-hmm. I just like, I didn't need to talk that loud. I get really excited and mm-hmm. I get really loud. And
me too.
You know, and when I was young, I felt so much shame in it. And, mm-hmm. I was thinking about this on my drive home from work yesterday that like, I really enjoy being able to just be okay with my existence and be okay with where I'm at in life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, we're our own biggest critic. Yeah. And so like, you know, you talk about your loudness and I see you loving loudly and I hear you describing, I'm hooting and hollering for birds. And I'm just like, this is an incredible human.
Yeah. Like that's what we should be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's something that, you know, we're always going to be able to, like you said, we're our biggest critic mm-hmm. and we're always going to be able to recognize the most beautiful parts of someone else. Mm-hmm. But I think that we have a really hard time turning that mm-hmm. back on ourselves.
Yeah. I think one thing that we're talking about a lot is the quality of shifting perspective and changing story.
Yeah.
And whether that's to do with ourself and our self-view, but you also touched on earlier, you know, some people have this idea that of pests, and pests has a connotation to it.
Yeah.
Or I think about the word weed a lot.
Yeah.
These plants that are critical, you know, and are a nourishing food source for us.
Absolutely.
So I would love to hear you speak to the importance of shifting story and if there's any specific stories you think of right now that are necessary that we change.
You know, I think that there's one that comes to mind immediately, and I think that we've done a really good job changing it. Mm-hmm. But I kind of touched on it earlier that these Hawkwatch sites were founded because people were gathering for target practice, mm-hmm. which we now look at these birds and we're like, what amazing, incredible, mm-hmm. elusive birds that everyone wants to see. And they were, you know, once viewed as pests, and people really, I mean, I do it all the time. I anthropomorphize. I think that it's a really natural thing to do. But
oh, same.
People anthropomorphize these birds to a really detrimental extent. They're not these like terrible, cruel murderers that people have described them as. You know, mm-hmm. there's plenty of examples of literature, you know, mm-hmm. government literature from the early to mid 1900s of these birds being cruel mm-hmm. and, you know, terrible and just like these really loaded, emotionally yeah. loaded words to describe them. And that really seeps into how people view them. The language that we use, I think, is huge.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that being able to shift any story starts with changing our language.
Yes.
You know, the first Hawkwatch sanctuary, this is like one of my favorite stories, mm-hmm. was started by a woman named Rosalie Barrow Edge mm-hmm. in, I want to say 1943, but she recognized that people were gathering and hunting these birds. And I mean, there were Audubon societies already around in Pennsylvania at that time. And she would go and have conflict with them because they would recognize the importance of passerines mm-hmm. and of waterfowl sometimes, but not of raptors. And mm-hmm. it was very this like selective, these things are good and these things are not, which I think mm-hmm. that we see a lot
yeah.
today in every realm of
yes.
the way that we approach things other than us. But she was one of the first people to be like, no, I think that we could actually benefit from accepting all of it, you mm-hmm. know, and not picking and choosing which ones we can serve.
Yeah.
And she was the first person. She bought the land that Hawk Mountain now occupies mm-hmm. and started the first Hawkwatch and migration site. And mm-hmm. she also helped influence the women's right to vote. She's a really cool person. You wow. should totally look
okay,
her up.
I will. Yeah, she's tell me her name again.
Rosalie Barrow Edge. Audubon Society has written multiple articles okay. about her.
Yeah.
They call her a Hellcat. Mm-hmm. She's a cool lady. Yeah.
Amazing.
But she, you know, like single-handedly was out there trying to change that story.
Yeah.
And I think that we've come a long way from that.
Yeah.
But, you know, with some of the other examples we brought up and even with raptors, now there's still a lot of that idea that, yeah, they're cruel mm-hmm. and that they're pests, or with the invasive species of starlings. Like, yes, there are totally ecosystem damages from these birds. Mm-hmm. We can acknowledge that there's these issues, but unless I'm the one that can do something about it, mm-hmm. I don't gain anything from having this negative outlook at it.
No.
And I think that it's something that's important for us to learn, is that we can hold both of those things true. Mm-hmm.
I love that you bring up language, because it truly is a perceptual bubble
yeah.
that we live the world through.
Yeah.
And it can help us. It can endanger us, other beings.
Yeah.
And when we shift language, we're calling ourselves into another state of relationship with the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's something that we get so trained into with the language mm-hmm. that we use, you know, how we talk about ourselves and how we talk about mm-hmm. other people and how we talk about the world around us. And I mean, I catch myself doing it all the time at the Hawkwatch. I'm like, oh, it's just a raven. You know, these ravens mm-hmm. are the size of red-tailed hawks all day. Mm-hmm. I am hoping that the raven's going to turn into a red-tailed hawk, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to really catch myself on that, because it's not just a raven. Mm-hmm. I've experienced people coming to sites looking just for the ravens.
Exactly.
And being able to shift one little phrase, mm-hmm. one idea, can really change our whole worlds.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about that recently, specifically the word just, you mm-hmm. know, and we catch ourselves in that too.
Yeah.
And that one word can be so minimizing
yeah.
and often unintentionally.
Yeah.
That's not the intention.
Yeah.
But what I love that you're speaking to is cultivating a sense of intentionality
yeah.
and not just operating in the world in an automatic way.
Yeah, because that automatic way is what keeps us in those harmful mm-hmm. language or thought loops or whatever it may mm-hmm. be. But yeah, that word just is such a killer. Mm-hmm. And I use it a lot.
Me
and
too.
I really am working on my intentionality of it. Because it's not fair to the people around me to minimize something for
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm. Goes back to what we speak to, always learning and opening up. And I think that something that comes up for me too is is the discernment of that, being consciously discerning of how we speak and how we act, and also in that being conscious of our selective power that we have as a humanity, and how when we select, if you will, cute species, quote unquote, know, that to really try and divest from that selective power.
Yeah, I think that that's something that we need to work on as a whole, humans, of picking and choosing what we view as good and bad, and even labeling things as good and bad. And I think that that can be applied to so many things. But with birds, you know, it's like the starlings from my first ornithology lab. Like, there were people saying it's just a starling, and I felt so like kind of hurt by it because I was so excited about this. And I was like, they're so pretty. And I felt very minimized. I felt very shut down, and I didn't like feeling like that. And who knows if that would have been my last day birding.
Exactly.
If I would have been in a place where I was really sensitive to the words of people around me and decided that, oh, well, I don't want to do this. I don't like the way that you guys approach these things. I don't like your attitude, whatever it may be, that, you know, our language can have such an impact on the people around us, and being selective can have such an impact on the people around us without us even realizing, because who are we to say what's good and bad?
Yeah. I just have a couple more questions for you, and then we'll get closed out. You got to go to Hawkwatch.
I know. So, got birds to count.
As a project lead and lead counter, what does that responsibility of leadership feel like to you? And what is important for you as a leader?
It feels really exciting. This is my first year as the project lead for this site. I've been really fortunate to work with some amazing women over the last few years. And so being able to step into the shoes of one of my mentors has been an immense honor, but it's been fantastic. And I try really hard to be compassionate. And I think one thing in the biologist realm of the world is technicians in particular are really expected to work to the bone. There's a lot of, you know, the older generation, honestly, that was expected of them. And they were expected to prove themselves that they were, you know, good enough and that they cared enough to be able to work full-time jobs. But being able to set a different example for the people that work with me feels like a real privilege, you know, and it's this balance of this is super important work and I love it and I'm so passionate about it. And I think that it's crucial and I never want it to stop. And also being able to recognize that I am a person and I'm a human being and I've got other needs, and being able to, lead that by example for young technicians around me feels like one of the best, like greatest privileges I've had working in this field so far.
Yeah. What a beautiful example to set, because this work never stops.
No, there's always going to be issues.
And we can't pour out care if we don't care for ourselves, and it needs to be sustainable too.
The sustainability is huge. I think that a lot of field technicians, when they graduate from college, they, you know, they hop right into the seasonal work. A lot of people, you know, won't pay rent somewhere and they'll hop between different jobs. And I did that for a few years. And then I kind of got to a point where I was like, okay, I need to fulfill another aspect of my life so that I can continue to do this work. And I opened a small business making art and jewelry, and I love it. And it's been a really great balance, so that when I'm not working, so instead of working spring, summer, fall bird seasons, I now will work spring, fall maybe, and then, you know, run my business outside of it. And it's really helped in that sustainability aspect. And making sure that we're not burning out as biologists, because it's hard. And especially with budget cuts and a whole slew of issues that biologists are facing right now, I'm not surprised at all to hear of people changing careers. It's devastating to be so passionate about something and to have that ripped away from you. And I think that as biologists who still have a job, luckily I work for a nonprofit. It's almost our responsibilities to make sure that we're not burning out so that we can continue this work.
And it makes me think of an experience I just had recently, or a connection I just had recently, in that is something we can learn from animals too. I got talking to this wildlife artist. Her name, I believe, is Tori Price, and I will correct that if not. Cool. But she has a collection called The Power of Rest. And it's all an ode to big cats that we revere as so strong and powerful, yeah. but we forget they sleep 20 hours
all
a day.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. I've never heard of that. Yeah, I'll totally check that out.
This has been such a lovely conversation.
Yeah, it's been fantastic.
I know.
I expected to talk about hawks and have a great time, but yeah, I'm so grateful we had this conversation. I think that there's a lot that we brought up that I'm going to continue thinking about.
Me too. So thank you for your enthusiasm, for your vulnerability, for your joy, your effervescence.
Oh, thank you.
And just a quick check-in. Is there any last things on your heart, your mind, your soul that you feel like want to be shared right now?
Well, I figured I should plug Dinosaur Ridge Hawk Watch just a little bit.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
So we count March 1st to May 10th every spring. Mm-hmm. It's at the Stegosaurus Lot for those. Mm-hmm. You can put that into your Google Maps. And then it's the Dakota Ridge Trail. It's about a little over a half a mile hike up. We're there from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day, weather permitting. As we know in Colorado, these springs get crazy windy.
Yeah.
We cancel our count with 25 mile per hour winds sustained. So, you know, if there's some crazy winds or if you can't see much, if visibility is low, we're not there, but we'll be there through May 10th. And our peak season is really upon us. We are waiting to still see the Swainsons and the Broadwing Hawks, but we can see 17 species of raptors at Hawk Ridge.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. Dinosaur Ridge. Sorry. I've worked too many places. At Dinosaur Ridge. Which is, you know, our numbers may be low for hawk watches across the country, but our diversity is pretty unmatched. One day, I think we counted like 13 raptors or something, which is so low in the grand scheme of things, but we had 7 species.
Wow.
So we can see some really amazing things. And if Broadwing Hawks are something that you haven't seen in Colorado before, those guys are really special. And we last year counted 140 of them migrating through. Yeah, which is really spectacular.
Mm-hmm. And so for people to sign up, is that, what's the website? Where should they go?
So dinosaurridgehawkwatch.com is our website. You can sign up like that. We accept volunteers year round, well, season round. We luckily this year have an amazing turnout for volunteers. So if you don't feel like you want to volunteer, you can just come. Whenever. Like I said, it's on a public trail. And so I have plenty of people that have been coming the whole 4 years that I've been working here that have never once signed up on a calendar. And that's okay. We just ask, you know, if you're planning on coming in today to see if there's anyone signed up. But yeah, you can come up whenever you want to. If you want to get more involved, Dinosaur Ridge Hawk Watch website is a really great place to start. And we send out, you can sign up for our email list. We send out our reports every day. Myself or Audrey type up some really nice notes on the day. So you'll get a report of the numbers, you know, the birds that we counted, but some fun anecdotes about the day. We see elk, deer, coyote. There's a three-legged elk hanging around Jefferson County.
Wow.
Yeah. We saw her last year. I called CPW and I was like, hey, I'm really concerned about your elk. And they're like, oh, we know about her. And she is okay. Like, she's been around for a couple years. So
resilient.
Yeah. So there's always something amazing to see up there.
Well, thank you, Emma. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, and it has.
Thank you to everyone tuning in. Remember, your actions matter. One thing you can do is go count raptors or any daily actions of care. And there you have it. This has been The Curious Bird. Thank you to our guests, our editor, Joe Escanos, and to you, our audience, for your time, curiosity, and openness. If you'd like to see these conversations continue, we would greatly appreciate your consideration in donating to our nonprofit, which you can do at the link in the episode information. Your generosity helps keep the conversations and our work flowing. To the bird lovers, the bird curious, the heart-centered, and any and every listener, until next time, when we meet again to build bridges, heal from separation, remember interconnectedness, and hear from the real inspired voices that are creating change in service to coexistence.